Let's head over to the Zoom line. Mark Workman on the line with us, RMI Supply, as we discuss a little bit about some of the supply chain issues and realities that are happening here across industry. How are you doing today, sir?
Doing really well. I appreciate you allowing me to have I'm interested in this subject very much. I thank you for reaching out.
Well, you've got a background in trucking. You've got a background in oil and gas. That makes you an expert, in my opinion, because both of those industries are extremely diverse and extremely vast. So when something happens like the Suez Canal, where there's a blockage or there's a spill and off Huntington Beach, or there's a bridge in Baltimore that has issues, talk to me about what happens with the supply chain, just from a macro standpoint, from how you see it, because we're starting to hear that some people are already being impacted by this Baltimore bridge supply chain thing.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And what happens is like a lot of times we think there's this immediate logistics breakdown and me, you know, I'm not going to get my whatever product I already have on the water next week or whatever. That's not the case. Kind of the way I see this is that logistics is just, it's just wound so tight, and it's so like the on-time delivery, on-time inventory in every area of our lives, right? From our food to airplanes and, you know, all this stuff, it all flows to every product line. And it's the same thing with these cargo ships and the massive amount of freight being moved around the world. And what happens is there's this wrinkle that occurs in some remote place that doesn't seem like it should matter, but it'll throw the whole system off. That wrinkle is a ripple that goes across the globe, regions and that kind of thing. You know, for example, just for me, like we kind of saw ahead of time on one of our products we import from China. It was xanthan. And we saw some of the stuff in the Red Sea and the attacks and, you know, the war there, you know, all that kind of stuff through cargo rates doubled essentially in about 4 to 5 weeks. But we kind of beat that, ordered in 32 loads before that and kind of beat that and say had some cost savings there. But the problem is that those ripples, they just come so quickly. That's the part, is you can't even hardly plan a little bit. There's a part of it, it comes quickly with like the price changes on the cargo. And then on the other side, you might see a problem getting a product 4 or 5, 6 months down the road because of something. So it's kind of the short-term, long-term problem. It's hard to navigate, in my opinion. And I think, you know, we just disregard, because I live in Montana, operate in Texas, and you know, what's happening in the Panama Canal or the Red Sea doesn't matter to me. Well, it does. And it affects all of us, not just my industry or what I'm doing, but it affects every everyday person.
Oftentimes in the energy industry, hurricanes and natural disasters can really set a ripple effect to the supply chain down in the Gulf of Mexico or obviously on the coast and a number of different things. One of the things that I found during these supply chain issues, small businesses have a little bit of an opportunity if they have a little bit of liquid cash. And what I mean by that is, I'll give you a personal example of, you know, just trying to track different supply chains on a personal side. You know, this is 20 some years ago, but we bought, I don't know, like 10, 25 pound bags of rice back when they were like $15. And the guy at the health food store, where was the place where you could buy bulk rice, he thought we were a bit crazy, our family. Well, you know, we had like 5 years of rice taken care of. Rice lasts a long time. Well, the next week, rice doubled in price. And wow. We had saw some things. I worked at an ag station primarily at the time. And so I saw some of the different supply chain issues happening. I have a background in trucking as well. So I get when the transportation logistics happen. Now that I've seen from the oil and gas side and covered several of these petrochemical refineries that go down or the Suez Canal, you can kind of see how the energy sector can get a little bit of a hiccup. So what I see is there's a real opportunity for small business, if they have some liquid cash, to do what you did. Buy ahead. Have a little bit, you know, if you got a place to store, because the bigger companies, they can't do that. They got to go through meetings and board of directors. And when this stuff happens, you got to move quick, don't you?
Yeah, being nimble is absolutely crazy good. You know, and right now, if you know anything about the oil sector, everyone thinks it's this massive industry, right? That it's all worldwide, global, and it really is. But at the same time, there's probably, you know, 1,000 decision makers. It's a very small club, very small industry. It's getting smaller. It's being consolidated. The big boys are keep buying up everybody. You're going to end up with Baker Hughes, Halliburton, you know, I mean, you know, even Newpark right now is, you know, in kind of a reorganization situation. And they're a huge player, you know, around the world. 70% of their income comes from outside the country, and they're getting ready to be bought up and swallowed up by, you know, a Weatherford or whoever's going to get them here by June or July. And so they can't even hardly make a decision. It takes them maybe months to make the decision that I made on December the 8th. And I said, we probably should bring some more in. And I did it in 5 minutes, you know. Does that make sense? You know, in the sense of just the ability just to realize right the fundamentals right in front of me tell me there's going to be an increase in cargo costs. I can make a decision very quickly. They are very, very, you know, so bureaucratic that it's hard on them, you know. And again, but they own the market and they have this, you know, everyone goes to them. And so they have a lot of power on the other side too. But at the same time, some of those inabilities to make decisions and be nimble, it definitely will affect your bottom line. And they know it. They'll tell you right to your face that, oh, we can't hardly move very quickly. We got to go through all these approvals for whatever. But it's a real challenge for them.
One of the areas where small businesses have a disadvantage is the exact opposite of that, which is they need time on their side. They do not necessarily have investors to continue investing in the company, do not have government to protect the shareholders, so to speak. So
no.
When it comes to these supply chain issues, there is a little bit of a time factor. And then there's also a workforce issue as well, because if you can't afford to keep your workforce on, well, now you might lose somebody, and now you've got a different supply chain issue. It's you have the product, but you don't have the workforce supply chain issue. Talk to me about that side of the supply chain, because that's a side very few people talk about.
Yeah, and during COVID, it showed its ugly head, obviously. And when we had product out at the port of Houston for and it would arrive, and usually we can get it released within just a few days in on a container on a truck into our yard. You know, that's the typical thing over my whole career. And during COVID, we would be told day in and day out, oh, the load, yours is going out today. They just tell you what you want to hear, obviously. But it just wouldn't come for sometimes weeks. And it's simply because couldn't get drivers. And I think the vaccination thing, they couldn't get on ports sometimes. If, you know, whatever the rules were, I don't remember now, but I know there was constant. And they didn't have enough drivers, didn't have enough trucks. We needed 15 people a day, and we're getting one. Literally one person a day. It was killing us, you know, to try to bag and prepare and get this product out, because we still had activity in the oil field, but we just couldn't get anyone to come. So it was really a terrible time. So what we did is we automated and built some of our own bagging machinery. You know, we literally self-built it and designed it. Our liquids can be loaded in pails within about 2 hours. You can load a whole truckload of pail product for the oil field, labeled and get ready to go on a truck that day. We can do that in about 2 hours. And we do that now with three people rather than 15. And so we had to become leaner with the employee thing, simply because there was just no one wanting to work, you know. So it was a real challenge. And the big boys have got to be dealing with it, you know, as well, because they have such a beast to feed, you know, a company that is kind of feeding on itself. They've got to always be hurting on that side of it. But the labor shortage and, you know, the great quitting, you read about that. I think it's called the great quitting or the great, I can't remember exactly how they term it, but basically a lot of people are just walking away from, you know, the traditional work life and either trying to do their own entrepreneurial thing or, you know, I don't even know where they're going, but they call it the great quitting the last few years. And you're probably aware of that yourself, I'm assuming.
Well, you know, this is a little bit of an editorial here. It concerns me because there's the, you know, the great quitting, the great resignation, whatever you want to call it. This came after the great cruise shift. So industry had about a 90% shift because there was a lot of retirees in the oil and gas industry specifically. And as the world gets to AI and automation and moves more into what is called a thought worker or knowledge worker industry, and
Interesting.
not so much of the physical labor, because that's starting to be replaced a little bit more by robotics.
It is, yep.
So I got rid of my television in 2006, and I got rid of it because I did not want my son to grow up around 24-hour news networks and commercials. Too much negativity around for me, too much fear, too much suggestion. So I made a choice as somebody who's been in the media my whole life since I was 10 years old. I just wanted my son to have an environment free of that. So I became very sensitive to traditional television and the commercials and what they were advertising and et cetera, right? So when I, by the way, I've survived eight recessions. My company in 2008 went bankrupt, and it was a publishing company. We had a real estate magazine as our main money getter. So the real estate market tanked and the publishing industry tanked in 2008 to 2012. So I don't feel as bad as losing that recession because I survived a bunch of other ones, but I learned a lot. And what I learned is that during that 2008 recession, one of the largest recessions with the largest bailout, too big to fail in history of the United States, was they were giving away loans like it was candy at a street corner, like at a parade. I mean, I was getting three, four calls a day from telemarketers just offering me $20,000-$30,000. And all I had to do was say yes. And they would just give it to me right over the phone while I was waiting at a red light. I mean, you couldn't make this stuff up. Well, over the past month, because I've been kind of on the road a little bit and traveling and in hotels, and March Madness has been playing, I put March Madness on. Now I'm starting to see commercials again. And in the same way they were like doing those ads for housing and home equity loans, now they're just doing it for business loans. So what I'm seeing is I'm seeing the same exact thing that they did with housing. They're doing it with business people. So you're going to see a rash of bankruptcies. You're going to see a rash of foreclosures. You're going to see banks having to get bailed out within the next year. I really believe that. And I haven't done the research yet, but just based off of what I've seen from what they're doing in the media, I think they walked us right into the same housing crisis, but now with a business crisis. And you know, who knows what they'll do after that? I mean, if that'll be the final nail in capitalism, and now we're just going to take care of everybody after that, or what? I have no idea, but there's going to be a giant crash for small businesses and startups coming very soon. The whole tech economy needs funding every 3 to 5 years. That's been the way ever since Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Oracle. Those companies need funding every 3 to 5 years. So when states are starting to get behind companies, and you have public-private partnerships, and you have nonprofits that are now competing in the private sector, it's the Wild West, but there's somebody behind the Wild West. It's just a big change. But anyway, sorry, I didn't want to get on my soapbox there, but it's just I'm really actually kind of afraid for the changes that are going to come to people that do not see it coming. And I don't know if it'll be as severe as I'm saying, but changes are coming.
Oh no, the whole thing is getting ready to be, the paradigm is getting ready to change. And this is my opinion too. So I'm editorializing as well, but my view is that if you're in, so many people are over leveraged, and everybody's over leveraged. You know, we stay clean, we're out of debt, we own everything. I'm kind of operated, I grew slowly on purpose, you know, so I wouldn't I don't have anyone on my neck. I can go a long time without orders, you know. So that's the goal, you know, is to be able to survive. Because the volatility is coming quicker. It used to be every 8 years, 9 years, you'd have volatility. Now you're having volatility every 2.5 years. You know?
Correct.
So the volatility is coming. So I have 2 good years, and I just watch my P's and Q's and stay out of debt, don't over leverage, and I know there's another blip coming. And in that blip, another heritage, long time, third generation company goes away all the time. QMax, this is name them, all of them that are gone, right? Just one right after another. And it's just amazing. And then those entities, all their equipment, everything is sold off to one of the big boys. So that volatility is getting companies about every 2.5 years. And what's happening for us, and this is what I'm seeing as a small company, is the more that volatility comes and I kind of go through to the other side, I grow again. You know, I'm always, because we service, when a customer calls, they get me. And I, you know what I mean? So it's not like it's a salesman or, anything like that. So, and I have a series of guys that do these things. But because of the way we've not leveraged in the debt thing and taken the money, we've been offered the money. And I don't take it. Nah, I don't want to, and I've just learned to just stay in my lane. And, that kind of thing. But it's everywhere. Like in the town I live in Montana, there's over 750 nonprofits, and then they're putting in coffee shops competing with the local private coffee shop trying to sell coffee to make a living. And they're nonprofits that are funded. I mean, even on that level, it's across the board, is this, the private, you just mentioned it, it's just not going to last. And,
it's difficult because excuse me here, sorry about that, got a little bit of an alert there, sorry about that. We work in the media, we get different alerts in different areas. But one of the issues is this thought worker space is really where you're starting to see the bleed over, because nonprofits traditionally were in the thought worker space. You did not have a construction company as a nonprofit. You do not have an oil company as a nonprofit. That doesn't happen. You do have a consulting company as a nonprofit. You do have now coaching companies or podcasts, or I bet you're going to get to real estate and accounting companies pretty soon. Any kind of office job that doesn't require heavy lifting, that's like open to a nonprofit now. And the way that they're starting up left and right, now that I know it's the government funding, I went through this in 2008, like I said, and I firmly believe the government, the way they fund it and who they fund it and the stipulations they put on the funding to get the tech sector going, it destroyed the newspaper industry. The newspaper industry was the originators of the content. They were the creators of the news, and the radio and the television often reacted to that. The internet was completely a reaction to it. But what happened? What ended up happening is the government gave money to Google. It gave money to Facebook. It gave money to Twitter. It gave money to Yahoo. And it gave money to other tech companies that literally stole intellectual property from the newspapers and redistributed it on their platform. Now, they got the word stolen taken to redistributed because the newspaper tried to sue and they lost. And I'm not 100% sure it has to do with the internet, but in the same way. So what ended up happening is really the government subsidized Facebook, Yahoo, Google, Twitter, all these different companies on a variety of different ways. on a variety of different ways. And now that's what they're doing too. But they're doing it with nonprofits and public-private partnerships and a variety of different things. And it's absolutely remarkable that they do not see how it's competing in the private sector when, as your example so astutely pointed out, they're getting into coffee shops now. I mean, we in Fargo, we've got like orthopedic people that are nonprofits competing with the hospitals.
Yeah.
And you can't do that. I mean, and so, and actually we got people working in the agriculture space now working against farmers because right. They're a nonprofit that's, you know, trying to save the world by feeding them and things like that. So anyway, I got to step down off that soapbox. I'm sorry, man.
No, it's okay, but that's fine.
Getting back to the supply chain issues, at the end of the day, though, what we just talked about, the consolidation and some of the mergers and acquisitions and just some of the activity that's happening, these do contribute to the supply chain issues as well, because as you centralize and you globalize, you have a less of a supply chain, but that means more problems.
Yeah, no, I believe historically, you know, that there's more problems coming. And there's a book I read that the time of less is upon us. The time of more is over. And basically, that's based on the idea that logistics over the last 20, 30 years has been because of historically America protecting the oceans. We guaranteed free trade. We were able to get things anywhere from a bike made in Ireland could be sold in Kansas City. And, you know, we're doing all these things. Well, you got the BRICS nations, you got all kinds of groups starting to form, and the logistics and the relationships are changing like so quickly. And, you know, I just think we're heading for a real paradigm change overall in finances and logistics and all those kind of things. And then, like you said, the consolidation, here's another issue for me, is all these guys, as they keep buying up companies and getting bigger and bigger and bigger in the oil field, in this, they have a lot of power. So they can call the rail guys and say, we need 100 rail car unit train twice a week, da da da. So I call to get a rail car, I need three. No, we can't help you. You know, you're out. You don't have any power. You know, so you start competing within the industry in a weird way because they can command so much demand. Command so much demand. But anyway, the like Baker Hughes or whatever, they just have way more influence and power than I have. So I've got to figure out how to beat that. And so as they get bigger, they, you know, like Dow Chemical, like I used to call them for a load of styrene beads I would sell. I was a distributor for them. And they want to sell, you know, 100 rail cars. They want to sell 20 truckloads of that. They don't want to sell, I want to buy a half truckload of that. I have a customer in West Texas that needs them. Da-da-da, and I put more order in. I might not hear from them for 3 weeks, even though I prepay it in order, you know, because I don't have any power. So, but if, Schlumberger or somebody else calls, they get a return call pretty quick because they're going to buy 20 loads. And I get it. But at the same time, as this changes, it's just going to get more bottled up, in my opinion, because I'm valuable. My small company is valuable. It provides a service just like theirs, but it's probably better service, you know, in my opinion. But at the same time, we're valuable. The smaller company is very valuable and should not go away.
Well, that's one of the things about supply chain issues is the smaller companies really have a time to shine. They really have a time to be quick and nimble, because a lot of the bigger companies still do need those services every day, even though they do not have the ability to be quick and nimble. So RMI Supply, let everybody out there know what exactly you do for the supply chain and how you can contribute and save people some money right now.
Well, we're a provider to the oil field in different specialty additives and chemicals, friction reducer, liquid PHPA, liquid XAN. And again, anyone in the oil field will know those are four. But typically, like one of our competitors has a 5 to 6 week lead time literally for like our liquid PHPA, you order in the AM today, it'll be on a truck by 2 in the afternoon going to your site. So we're shipping in 24 hours because of the way we've automated, the way we set up, and we have a capacity of up to 8 truckloads a day of the various liquids. And so we have all the raws in, all the product in, and we can manufacture up to 8 loads a day of PHPA, friction reducer, any of those are, you know, set to go. So we have a pretty high capacity for a small company. And then we're very, very fast. We're almost too fast. Like the guys now are starting to, when they put in an order, well, we don't need it till next Thursday. You know, they'll say to me, and I'm like, okay, I'll wait, because we're almost too fast for them. But, and that's what's interesting about it is service, and we're not cheap. We're not the cheapest, you know, and I don't want to be the cheap, low guy, low tech, low quality guy. I'm a high quality. I go for the highest grades. You know, I go for everything is like the tops, you know, so it's not tech grade, API, lower grade. So I go for the high grade. And then the service side of it is, you know, literally day a day compared to 4 to 5 weeks if you call my competitor. So the value in that, there is value in that. And that's where I'm saying, like, our small companies do offer value in its service, and you're talking to the right guy. If there's a problem, you're not going to go through a menu system on a phone to get to anybody that might not even know about your order, you know, whatever you're dealing with. So it's very challenging for them. But for us, we're just so service oriented and quality oriented. I think my guys that I know I deal with love it, and they'll tell me that.
Mark Workman, RMI Supply. That's RMISupply.com. Thank you for the time today.
Hey, I appreciate you. Thanks so much.